When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Today's episode is sponsored by Bear Attack Boxing, providers of high-quality boxing equipment. And today, I want to talk about the Power Focus Pads. Now, they are focus pads that are ideal for training your boxing students and also for boxing training as well. They've got extra thickness and they're very, very shock absorbent. This pad is ideal for getting them big hooks, big right crosses, the big uppercuts, the great selection of shots thrown by fighters. So guys, go over and check them out at www.bearattackboxing.co.uk. Go and check out their new product, which is the Power Focus Pads. Only $24.99. Get over there, check them out. Check them out on social media at Bear Attack Boxing on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter.
And right now, Thomas Hearns is an open book to Ray Leonard. Backs up against the ropes.
This is one of the most unusual calls by a referee in the history of the sport.
The first loss.
A tremendous victory. Leonard fighting off the ropes.
It happened. It happened. An uppercut by Douglas. Down goes Tyson.
Thompson, right hand shot.
An excellent. Knocked out by Tyson.
Now slumps to the canvas.
The champion struggles to stay on his feet.
How do you like it?
Welcome, fight fans, to another episode of BTR Boxing Podcast Legendary Nights. And today's episode, as voted for by you, the listeners, is the tale of Nigel Benn versus Chris Eubank from November 1990. And before we get into the episode today, I want you guys to go and check us out on social media at BTR Boxing Pod and BTR Boxing Podcast on Facebook as well. If you've not already subscribed to the podcast, go and find us on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Stitcher, Spreaker, Player FM, Spotify. We're on all the good available podcasting apps out there. So, as voted for by you, the listeners, the users of Twitter, you've voted for Nigel Benn versus Chris Eubank as your legendary night for this week. We're going to be exploring the build-up to the fight, we're going to be exploring the careers of both men leading into the fight, and we're going to be exploring the fight itself and what this meant for the aftermath of their careers. So here it is, guys. This is the next episode of BTR Boxing Podcast Legendary Nights, and it's the tale of Nigel Benn versus Chris Eubank. So this is it, this is the tale of Nigel Benn versus Chris Eubank way back in 1990. Delighted to say Johnston Brown is on the phone recording this episode with me today. This is a fantastic episode and what a great pick and what a great selection of fights you put out on Twitter for us, Johnston.
Yeah, no, it was difficult because, you know, 1990 era, it was so many good fights, but, you know, Ben Holyfield in there, obviously, but, you know, Ben Eubank won. Could have gone with Ben Eubank too, but I thought Ben won. Probably it was the better fight. So, yeah, really looking to go through this classic, unforgettable encounter.
Yeah, this is an unforgettable encounter indeed. So, as always, we'll be covering off the fighters' careers, briefly going to date to the fight. We'll be covering off the build-up, which we've got an interesting build-up to discuss today. And then we'll be covering the fight and the aftermath. Really excited for this one. So, as always then, let's go into it. Let's talk a little bit about these guys. So, first of all, before we go into the careers, I just wanted to briefly give my thoughts and get yours on both men, really. Both men and your memories of these two guys. Just sort of going into this particular fight. Looking back on things for me, Johnston, I was like, I got so many good memories of both fighters for what they did in their careers, but this particular fight, the build up to it, watching it back, was it made you feel like it's something that's kind of missing from today's era, something that we don't have anymore, something that feels a bit more fabricated in this day and age, whereas this particular fight, as a lot of people know, it was just pure. It's just pure hatred between the guys at the time and probably still is today. And this for me, you know, memories of it wise, was just, it was just epic. It was just an epic event that we'd not seen on these shores for a long period of time.
Yeah, absolutely, Sean. I Ben was always my favourite as a kid. I mean, I was only 8 when this fight happened. So, you know, my memories of the fight are more to do with my brother watching it, cheering on Ben, shadow boxing as he's watching it, and just being in like in awe of what the hell's going on type of thing. And I was 8 years old thinking, what the hell is this? I've never seen this before. And then obviously, you know, with the build-up and just the hatred and watching back as an adult. And, you know, with Eubanks, my brother wasn't a fan of Eubanks. So being 8 years old, I followed suit, and I was never a fan of him myself, always a Ben fan. You know, the guy, he was more into, he was more entertaining. Eubanks probably had the whole package, didn't he? He had that Marmite sort of style in terms of, you know, with the public, where people would love to hate him, which Barry Hearn tapped into really well. And then obviously with Ben, he was obviously the Dark Destroyer, and he was just a monster. He just wanted to throw bombs. You know, he was that bob and weave style and throwing his shots. And he was a real fan favourite, and it really did. It was a great, great fight, and obviously everything else up before it. Completely with showing it was just great, you know, to be around at that time. I suppose, as I say, I was only young, but it was pure hatred and genuine, not this fabricated stuff as you said, as it is today.
So let's talk about Nigel Benn then, first of all, starting his career way back in 1987, and it was something you touched on before we recorded this episode today, was that the words you used was, they don't make him like this anymore, and you're very, very right, because Nigel Benn, in 1987, what was it, 1, 2, 3, about 12 fights in his first year as a professional?
Unbelievable, isn't it? 12 fights in 1987. He debuted in January, and he had that in his first fight, and his 12th fight was on the 2nd of December 1987. 12 fights. Unbelievable. Knocked them all out.
I know, that's the crazy thing about it, is that it's, and scary about it, the fact that he knocked every single one of them guys out going into 1988, and moving into 1988 is where he started to really come to fruition in the middleweight division. He won the vacant Commonwealth middleweight title against Abdul Sandar in 20th of April 1988. He moves on. He also defended it against Anthony Logan. He also defended it against David Noel, and then he also defended it against Michael Shalambi as well, moving into 1989. So, he was very, very good fight. He was knocking everybody out. He was just the thing for me that stands out the most, and what people do remember Ben by, is the fact that he knocked a lot of people out. He was very, very hard when he was punching. He was such a tough man, and he had power in both of them fists.
Oh, absolutely. And he had this style where he literally knew he was going to get you. I mean, he actually made a comment as well saying that, he fought a couple of Mexican road sweepers, which is quite funny. And that's pretty much what Ben was like of that time. So, you know, not all of them were, you know, they were pretty small names. But, you know, 12 fights in and he's knocked out 12 fellas in 1 year. You know, you're not going to be fighting anyone major. So, but just to knock these guys out says it all. And obviously, you mentioned the Logan fight. The Logan fight was an interesting one because Ben was actually put down in the first round in that Logan fight. And then He also had to sustain an unbelievable flurry from Logan, which today the fight probably would have been stopped. He's under so much pressure and he just lands his big shot, massive one punch knockout, which is what Ben was all about. He had that one punch knockout, and the one thing with Ben that I think the fans really liked, obviously knocking people out, but the fact that when he was in trouble, and he was almost like a wounded animal, where he would actually be more dangerous. So that was always a great marking point for Ben with the fans. And they, you know, you can't, once when he's in trouble, you're thinking it's over. Not with Nigel. Nigel will find a way. He had a will to, he had this unbelievable will, and he would put you away.
He certainly would, and that was evident, obviously, through his first part of his career. And then he bumped into a certain Michael Watson in 1989 at Finsbury Park, where he lost via a TKO stoppage to Michael Watson, who, again, was another fantastic British middleweight of that particular era. And a great fight to go back and look on in terms of looking at the career of Nigel Benn. You think about these fights. Although he lost this fight, this was an absolutely brilliant fight.
Oh, unbelievable fight. The fourth round in particular was absolutely superb. It was like literally one for the ages. It was non-stop. I mean, Benn went for it because that's what he never really had any plan B. The plan A was to just go in there and wipe someone out. And Michael Watson, as you say, was also... I mean, you got Watson, Eubank and Benn, and the three of them, you know, they were all three of them from London, and the argument probably was at the time is that Watson may have even just been above Benn. He obviously beat him, but he covered up well, he took the shots well, and then obviously Benn just sort of tired him out, he got tired, and then he got caught a few times, got stunned Benn, and inevitably he actually got put down with a jab, funny enough. Which the fight stopped, referee counted him out. It was a bit of an interesting count out. The crowd went a bit mad. I mean, loads of people come tearing into the ring, so some of the broadcasters were a little bit nervous about whether it's going to kick off or not, but obviously Watson then went on to fight Mike McCallum literally straight after this, so Benn losing that fight, in actual fact, it served him well in terms of his, you know, of going forward, because you know, as we say, a defeat is never a bad thing, and obviously I think that today's society, we're a little bit, you know, I think some of these fighters, they're not interested in losing. They're a bit worried about losing their unbeaten record. But as Benn proved here, that it makes no difference. It actually makes you a better fighter.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I agree with that statement in today's generation of boxing and the fighters that are out there at the moment. So, obviously, you lost to Michael Watson. He moves on, goes straight back in, goes over to Atlantic City, gets a unanimous decision against Jorge Amparo, and then goes to Las Vegas and beats Jose Quinosas with a TKO victory there in 1989. Goes into 1990, so we're getting into the 90s, which is what this particular fight we're talking about today was in. And then we get Sunderland Williams, who he beats in Atlantic City via a split decision. And then this is where, for me, where his career obviously started to really take off, when he then fought in April of that year, 1990, Doug DeWitt for the WBO middleweight title of the world, picking up a TKO victory and his first world title.
Yeah, it was a real turning point for Benn. He went to America, sort of adjusted his style slightly, not too much, but I think the America, you know, being in America, I think he tried to just become a little, he learned from the Watson fight, put it that way. But in saying that, again, when he was under pressure, he would just end up throwing bombs, because that's what it was about. And actually, Doug DeWitt put him down, and then Benn put him down, I think, in the third. So he was put down in the second. Benn then put DeWitt down in the third, and then it was the free knockdown rule as well. So that was what done it. I mean, to be fair, DeWitt was in the state to continue in a way. But yeah, he won it on the free knockdown rule, which was obviously the rules that the WBO had put in, which was the lesser title as well. So at the time, anyway, it was a new title. So it wasn't as highly regarded as the other two.
And the next fight, this is even greater. Iron Barclay and Nigel Benn. Wow, what a fight this was. A one-round KO from Nigel Benn. Oh, my God. This is I've, you know, I'm emphasising the oh, my God in this, because I tell you what, this was an absolutely fantastic fight. It was just frantic from the off. And when you look at Nigel Benn's career, this kind of epitomises what his career was, really, when you get these particular fights where they're just absolute constant back and forth action. And we'll be talking a little bit about some of the other fights later on down the line in the episode, but this Iron Barclay was a guy that was supposed to beat Nigel Benn. Nigel Benn wasn't supposed to go in there and do a number on Aaron Barclay. He was the underdog, even though he was the champion. It was like he was going to America to give his title away to Aaron Barclay. But boy, did he go and do a job on Barclay in that fight.
Oh, unbelievable fight. If that fight, if there were, again, he won this with the three-time knockdown rule, again, with the WBO, which they implied. You sort of wish they didn't. It literally, from the first bell, Ben's got in, literally caught Barclay straight away. Rocked him to his senses. He literally went down, bounced off the ropes, and stood back up again. Barclay. It was a wonderful shot. And then obviously Ben tries to go for the finish and gets caught himself. He literally gets really badly caught, and you're thinking, "Uh oh, Barclay's got him." And then obviously he comes back, puts him down again. It was the last two knockdowns were actually a little bit. You know, he got up, Barclay. He wasn't in no fit state to continue. He could have probably carried on. So that three-time knockdown rule, unfortunately, it prevented what could have been. It could have been like a Hagler-Hearns in a way, because that was how this fight was going. It was an absolute belter. And funny enough, Barclay, just before that, did an incredible sequence of fights where he had actually beaten Tommy Hearns, lost to Duran, lost to Michael Nunn, and then eventually lost to Ben. So that three-fight sequence there is pretty impressive, or four fights, sorry. So just shows you, again, and Barclay, you know, Barclay beats Hearns twice, and then you've got, you know, Duran who beat Barclay, and then Hearns knocks out Duran. So it just shows you, styles make fights. And I tell you what, Barclay-Ben was an unbelievable fight, and it's just a shame it lasted around.
Yeah. You're right, it would have been a great fight to have seen go out at least another couple of rounds. But as you said, with the three knockdown rule, which was in place in the WBO at the time, that fight was stopped in the first round, which brought an unbelievable end to the fight and an unbelievable title defence for Nigel Benn, which led into this next fight, which was the fight we're talking about today versus Chris Eubank. So, Chris Eubank then, let's talk about him. Let's talk about his career going into the Benn fight. And one of the most notable things, you know, when looking at his career and going back all the way to the beginning, is that he actually had his first five fights in the USA, which I was very surprised about when I looked back on that. It wasn't something I actually knew about Chris Eubank going into doing this podcast. I didn't realise Chris Eubank had actually built his name on his first five fights in America, making his debut in Atlantic City. That was like, oh my God, not many people get to do that, especially in that particular era, in the 80s, when I don't think the money in boxing was nowhere near as big as it is today because of all the TV rights and everything else that goes with it. You think about in this day and age, a lot of fighters do get this opportunity, more so than ever now, but to be breaking your debut and then fighting another four times in America, what an unbelievable start to his career.
Oh, absolutely. And it also shows that, you know, obviously they see a talent in Chris. Obviously he had unbelievable talent. He had that sort of unusual style, unorthodox style. But yeah, funny enough, I mean, you say that, it was actually due to the fact that he was suspended, I think, 18 times in 1 year from his school over in England. And his dad ended up shipping him off to his mum in New York. So that's why he was out there, and he sort of changed his tune, and he tried to become a better person, and ended up finding boxing as they do. His first five fights in America.
He did, and then he come back over, back to the UK, started to build his reputation throughout the late 80s. So he fought at the famous York Hall, Bethnal Green. He fought at the Brentwood Centre, you know, places that you'll know very well. The Royal Albert Hall, another great boxing venue there down in London. Yeah, exactly. And this was where he started to really build himself as a fighter and establish himself as a fighter. Now, one of the interesting things about Eubank's career going into this particular fight was that prior to going into the fight with Nigel Benn, he'd actually never won a professional title as such in terms of the domestic side of the business. So he'd never actually been there and picked up a Commonwealth title or a British title, the Lord Lonsdale belt at this point. He'd picked up the WBC International middleweight title, which I suppose is the version of like what we get today, where it's like a WBC silver or something of that nature. But he'd never actually picked up the Lord Lonsdale or the Commonwealth at this point.
Yeah, it's interesting. He didn't go through that route, you know, the English, the British. Yeah, it, that is one thing I didn't, do you know what, I didn't even think about, actually. He was signed by Barry Hearn. I think Barry picked him up and brought him over here. He tried to nurture him in terms of having him as that Marmite character. But yeah, interestingly, he didn't, did he? I mean, the only one, looking at some of these names, is obviously the Anthony Logan fight, which he fought on the undercard of Ben, who was the headliner, which was in 1989, the year before they fought. So I think that was actually the fight when Eubank turned around and said, you know, he called Ben out. So that was when it started, if you like. And he had a lot of fights. He had 5 fights in 88, and then he had 9 fights in 89, which again shows you they don't make them like this anymore, Sean, at all. But yeah, really interesting. I never picked up on that. But yeah, not one, apart from, obviously, as you say, the WBC International, which obviously put him in a higher rank at the time.
But what was also interesting is going into the Ben fight, he'd actually had 4 fights previously throughout the year. So, you know, he started in March, and then he fought again in April, then he fought again in September, and then again at the end of September. So he fought 4 times before eventually going into this fight in November of 1990 with Nigel Benn. So I think it just goes back down to the fact that, like we were saying here, they don't make him like this anymore. And for him to have had that many fights in the space of a year, going into the biggest fight of his life, I think it's something to really respect, especially in our generation. I mean, you're thinking of this now, this is what, 29 years ago that this fight happened now, as we're talking about it in 2019. So as well as it making us feel old, it also hits home the fact that they don't make fighters like this anymore. I mean, they take fighters down different routes, and this is a route where he actually didn't go domestically through. He fought great opponents and international opponents, but then he obviously got this rankings belt, as we said, the WBC International Middleweight title, which put him in prime position to potentially fight for a world title. And then there was all this build-up, which is what we're going to go into in a moment, about the Nigel Benn fight. As you said, and you rightly pointed out, he'd called him out in 1989. And at the time, obviously, Nigel Benn went and picked up the World Boxing Organization World Middleweight title. So this made the fight even more interesting for fight fans. The fact that it was 2 British fighters contesting a world title, and it was going to be happening on this show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the crazy thing is, as well, is with Eubank, as you say, not picking up any going through the domestic route, if you like, but it is Barry Hearn as well. Credit to him, because he, you know, he was obviously involved in snooker, and he picked up, I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that was one of his first fights in Eubank. He sees something in Eubank, and he built Eubank in such a way that it captured the imagination. He was on terrestrial television and ITV. He had signed a contract. He was good friends with the guy, with Barry Hearn. I can't remember the guy's name, but who ran ITV at the time. So obviously getting Eubank on the bill, and obviously knocking a few guys out before that. He had a few points decisions, but just that arrogant style. And I'll go back to my brother, because there's one person I can look at here is, he absolutely detested Eubank, my brother. And that was very smart from Barry. Looking at it now, you think about it, you think, he's done a right one. He's done a really good job here, because people noticed him, not because he had picked out a British title, not because he was a European champion, but because of his style and his attitude and his confidence. He almost had this aura about him where what he was saying, you almost believed him. And he had that wonderful technique, and an unusual and unorthodox technique. And no matter how crazy the guy is, I mean, I think he's absolutely deluded with some of the things that he comes out with. But naturally, an unusual fighter to watch. And he talked himself into this fight at the end of the day. I mean, Ben probably didn't even need to take it. He was probably looking at, I think they even mentioned Sugar Ray Leonard after the Barkley fight. That was what they were looking at, the Rands and your Leonards at middleweight. But obviously, it didn't happen. But yeah, it was. He knocked out the Brazilian as well with like 10 seconds. So it was set up lovely for this big one in 1990.
And this is it. We're going to talk about this particular build-up to the fight, because in terms of build-ups, this is definitely one of them that gets you excited when you listen back to the audio of this particular build-up going into it, because there were some harsh words exchanged between these men. It was quite evident in the build-up to this fight that they absolutely despised each other.
Nigel Benn is talking to you.
Didn't faith me. Thing about him, he's all hype, you know, and I can't wait to November the 18th to give him a good hiding. You know, he went out there, he'd done the job on a guy. Who was he? Another Sanchez, Gomez, Lopez. Who was it? Another road sweeper? Hey, I've done that before. Now I'm with the big boys. I'm there. I'm there already. He's got to prove himself, not me.
I have what it takes. This man is nothing but he's the real hype. I come up the hard way. I've been
a prove myself, boy.
You had your time. Let's have some parliamentary procedure here, all right?
Oh, God.
I have nothing to say to Nigel. I find the man intolerable in that he's so wild.
You know, when they talk about boxing and they talk about fights, you know, fabricated, and they look like they're kind of putting it on to sell tickets, there was no fabrication at all with this fight. You could just see these two men just genuinely hated each other.
Oh, it was absolutely genuine dislike. I mean, they actually put the sign of the fight on TV. And, I mean, you sort of think, God, what are they doing? Like, but in actual fact, it worked so well. So you had, you know, you had Eubanks sort of sitting with his back to Ben, and it wouldn't look at Ben. And Ben's, you could see he was just really winding him up. I think, I can't remember the name of the host of the show at the time, but he was sort of saying, are you not going to sort of turn around and look at him? And Eubanks giving it the old, no, I'll look at him on the night of the fight. And then they're sort of saying, you know, I can see this genuine dislike. And Eubank comes with, I don't dislike him. I just want his WBO title. And Ben goes, I personally hate him. And he's saying the public are coming up to him telling him, you've got to knock out this cat. This cat is, you know, he's too big for his boots, and, you know, he's got a big head. You need to put him away, Ben. And then Ambrose Mendy, who was obviously his manager at the time, was also present alongside Ben. And then you had Barry Earn signing the contract and getting involved as well. And it just warmed up beautifully, really. And it, obviously the war of the words in between fights as well. So, yeah. It was fascinating to watch back, and I was only young, but I have these vague memories of my brother not being too best pleased with Eubanks.
In my opinion, although he's a great puncher, he has nothing else other than that.
Do you go along with that, Ambrose?
That's
Andy?
Why.
Not at all. Nigel Benn came. He came up the hard way. You know, we're going to find out on a night who's fooling who. In my opinion, Chris Eubank tries to talk as if he came out of some Silver Spoon society. He's a kid off the street the same as us, and we're going to find out on the night just who's fooling who. In regards to Chris saying that boxing is a mugs game, we've got something to show you. It's a piece of our own artwork. Perhaps you'd like to home in on that. It's a mugs game. And I'd say this, a Shakespearean quote for you young man to learn. How much sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. That's from all the professional boxers in this country.
Barry Hearn, why is this man the boxer they all love to hate?
Well, I don't think they do. I think that's an image that's been afforded to him by some of the journalists in Fleet Street. It takes a bit of time to appreciate Chris Eubank. But, you know, having said that, you know, I'm not detracting from either fighter, but we have a situation where Nigel Benn fought Michael Watson. Nigel Benn was the undefeated fighter that went in. Chris Eubank now is the undefeated fighter. He's there on merit. He is the man until he's been beaten. And it's going to be a very highly competitive fight between two great athletes.
Even going back and watching like the clips on YouTube, which is wonderful for us to watch in this day and age, it's great to watch back at the genuine disdain for each other. And, you know, you look at the modern-day rivalries that we've seen where we felt like there's genuine hatred between one another. And the one we covered a few weeks back with Froch and Groves is a perfect example of two guys that really just didn't like each other. There was no put on, there was no charade, it was just genuine dislike. Eubank, obviously, the Marmite character, as you referred to him earlier, he was that. He was very arrogant. He still is, but he was more so than ever back in the 90s. He was such an arrogant man that nobody liked, so eccentric, spoke in a certain way, mannerisms, everything about him was just, you either liked the guy or you really hated the guy and wanted to see him get knocked out by the likes of Nigel Benn. So this is what sort of split public opinion on the fact that Eubank was a beautiful boxer, great skill, great stylistically going in against a guy who was known for his knockout power, but also a guy that would come forward, and it was going to make for an interesting fight. It was definitely the boxer against the puncher anyway. That was for sure.
Oh, you saying that, Chris Eubank actually was quoted just before the fight saying, a competent and intellectual boxer against a shallow-minded puncher. That was basically how he built the fight.
That's typical Eubank, isn't it?
As a puncher, because a puncher never beats a boxer. So was very, he was very clever with how he phrased it. You can write his words down and know exactly what he's going to say and how he's going to say it. And that just wound Ben up, because Ben was, you know, he was, he was one of the people, wasn't he? He was, you could go out with Ben, you know. After the fight with Barkley, for instance, he was out on the Raz with his fans that had come over to watch him in Atlantic City. Whereas Ben, I don't think the fans quite got that. It was just his arrogant-minded, narrow-minded, and just self-obsessed with himself. And whereas Ben was like you know your guy next door, wasn't he? He was the guy that he was your mate. So I think that's what people loved about Ben, and it just set up for the hate for Eubank, and then the love for Nigel. And but you know it swings and roundabouts, because obviously as it develops, I think people start to appreciate how good Eubank was. But it was simmering nicely for the main event.
And this is some interesting information about this particular fight going into everything to the ring walk was when I looked up the information on it, this was great. I mean, watching the video back before looking at information for our episode was like, you know, this is great entrances. And then you sit there and you're watching Eubank come in, and you know he's got his Simply the Best by Tina Turner, and then as he's starting to come out, the music just completely stops. And now I never knew, watching back on that this was actually a sabotage by Ben's team. So what actually happened was, obviously, to get their own back on the way Eubank had been in the lead-up to the fight and how arrogant he'd been, one of Eubank's team decided to basically stop the record. Yes, record, for people that are over the age of 30. That is a very round, black, circular thing that goes on with a pin. You probably won't have seen him. Go on Google and check him out. Yes, so the record, Simply the Best, was actually stopped. So Eubank just carried on. He just carried on walking to the ring like a consummate professional, like nothing had even happened. So the music completely stops and he just carries on, goes in, does his vaulting over the rope as always. And then we get, obviously, Nigel Benn, who then comes in just looking like a mini Mike Tyson.
Yeah, it was brilliant, wasn't it? The funny thing is, as well, is the other thing I picked up, and I don't know if you might have as well, Sean, is that is Ben, because they used to do check weight before the fight, and on the morning of the fight, I think they said Ben woke up at sort of 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever, and he went, I need to check weight. And they went, all right. So he checked weight, and he was 6.5 pounds overweight for this fight, and he had 3 hours to lose it. So he spent literally the whole morning running around an underground roundabout, had done 3 miles on a treadmill with all his clothes on. Then he went into a sauna with 4 layers of clothing on and shadow boxed for 45 minutes to try and bring down that weight. In the end, he managed to go to check weight, and he checked weight. But after that, he couldn't eat anything. He literally had half a sandwich. So Eubank had a bit of an advantage, and Ben, you know, he was struggling. He's had to do a little bit more than he was supposed to be doing. So I think as well, with them stopping that record, that was also a part of trying to play mind games with Eubank, but in actual fact, just pissed Barry Earn off.
Well, that's something that not a lot of people may know about the fight, unless you're really hardcore and have really gone into the depths of these particular two fighters' careers. I actually never knew that this had happened in terms of his check weight and the fact that he had to do all these miles and the treadmill and the shadow boxing to actually, you know, drain the weight out of him to be able to get in there on the day and give it as a fair advantage as possible. But as you rightly pointed out, in this day and age, again, when I refer back to it, people, when they're absolutely drain themselves down to the bone, it definitely has a massive impact on their performance on the night. And I've always said this about boxing and the way these things go down. And evidently, I think when you look back on the fight and as we touch through the fight, you can actually start to see how this does come into play later on down the line of the fight. So, as we were saying then, going back to the entrances, once they got into the ring, one of the most iconic scenes in British boxing history happened as they both came to the middle of the ring and they both stared at each other, and it was just Eubank's typical glazed eye stare straight through Ben, and Ben's expression of just pure hatred and loathing for Eubank.
Yeah, I'll never forget it. I mean, it was intense, wasn't it? And even the way when they sort of went back to their corners as well, just before the bell sounded, and that iconic pose that I suppose you've got to say with Eubank with the hands and sort of the sort of side standing and glaring over to his opponent in the corner, and Ben was almost doing a similar thing, wasn't he? So they're both staring and waiting for that bell when they're ready. And Ben in his head thing, I'm going to absolutely rip your head off. So it was brilliant. It was great. You could feel the tension. I always go back to, I don't remember it as an eight-year-old. I was an eight-year-old in the front room with my brother and his mate. And my brother was so, he couldn't wait for it. He was 16, 17, my brother, and he was so eager for Ben to just wipe the smile off, this smirk off Eubank's face. And like, I could feel the tension in the room. It had that about it. I mean, you watch it on YouTube and the sound quality is not as great. And I don't think it really gives it the significant, obviously you can read stuff about it, but being in my front room, I tell you what, you couldn't have been any more intense. And my brother was just, it was really, it was a strange feeling. The one thing, obviously, 1990 was a big year because I remember, obviously, England, I'm a football fan, so I remember England in the 1990 World Cup in the summer and England losing, obviously, to Germany. So, and then this was the other part of 1990 for me. So there are two significant memories in my household, and I will never forget that. And that is one thing that will always stay with me. Exactly what you say, that intense, that hatred between the pair of them was, you can't replay it, almost like a penalty, you know, when you do it in training, you can't replay it when you're there in the stadium. So yeah, unbelievable. It was great to watch back in there. And it set it off nicely, didn't it? From the off.
Yeah, from the off, basically, you get Eubank coming out in that sort of trademark sideways stance, coming out really unorthodox looking and very sort of arrogant about it. It was just arrogance, pure arrogance. And he comes out and there's just no respect at all for Ben. Ben comes out and obviously you know exactly what Ben wants to go and do. And as you said, he wanted to go and rip Eubank's head off, and straight away he came out and he started throwing punches. But Eubank really smart in the early couple of rounds, where he's really trying to box against Ben and use the advantages he had as a fighter to try and overcome Ben. But Ben was just so ferocious, as we always known him as. He wouldn't stop. He took punches to get on the inside to get to Eubank, but Eubank actually caught Ben with a real good right cross in the opening stanza, and that was a significant start, and he really hurt Ben in that first round. And that, the commentators were absolutely going wild. It was like immediately, it was like a replay of the Iron Barkley fight. It was, you know, Ben comes out, starts throwing ferocious punches, Eubank catches him, nice great right cross, and then all of a sudden you just kind of see Ben's legs go a little bit and you're like, oh no. You know, if you didn't know the result before that, I can imagine the millions of people that watched it in 1990, you know, hearts would have been in the mouth at this point.
Eubank is going to have to come back. The punch is ready. He's not going to be able to strut. He's going to have to try and hurt Ben. He's done it.
He's done Ben by the look of it. He chopped that right hand down. That was right above us, Ben, almost falling down on the ring on us here.
This is where we've seen Ben so dangerous from this position. Here it comes.
He's always saying he likes to battle back, Ben. Well, he's got to do it here. Tried to do it with Watson, but it didn't work.
Ben's legs are shaking.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, Eubank, it was like a crab-like style, and it sort of glide around the ring sideways. It's really weird to watch, but it was obviously effective. And as you say, he was very smart. He was very clever. He almost used his jab a little bit. He looked like he was going to just literally, as he said, the boxer against, you know, the shallow puncher, as he put it. And Ben was obviously trying to get in close. And then he sort of roughed up his rhythm a little bit in that first round, Ben. And then obviously going into the second, as you say, that wonderful cross from Eubank. It was boiling up lovely. And then obviously that one particular shot, I think Ben's thrown a right hand and it was like a 1-2, if you like. And then he's caught him with a third. And it did. It stiffened Ben's legs. He's gone back to the ropes. And you are thinking, oh, my God. Luckily, it was the end of the round because, you know, to be honest, a minute and a half left, that fight could have been over. Let's be honest. I mean, he was a clinical finisher at Eubank, although he hadn't really been, he wasn't a seasoned pro, but he was confident and he was very clinical in the way he finished his guys. Saying that, Ben, like a wounded animal, wasn't he? So when he's hurt, he's at his most dangerous. So who knows what could have happened if that had continued. You know, literally, it happened right at the end of that second round. But it was looking great. It was a great start, and obviously, as you said, the commentators were feeding off that, and you could feel the excitement in the state in the arena.
That's right. And then we go into the third and fourth, and the fourth sticks out in my mind in particular when watching the fight back, was when Eubanks took an absolute ferocious right uppercut to the chin when breaking away from the clinch. That blow actually caused him to bite his tongue, which led him with a severe gash, which led to a lot of blood being swallowed. Eubank actually hid the evidence from his corner, something that has only been found out obviously after the event. So it, you know, we all know what it's like when you bite your tongue. It's horrible when you're eating a piece of food. But this guy had took an absolute huge uppercut, and obviously at the time the uppercut landed, he bit his tongue so hard that he'd caused a huge gash on his tongue. So there was blood literally coming in his mouth, but he was swallowing the blood, because if he would have let that blood come out of his mouth, they probably would have stopped the fight, because that's what would have happened. They would have seen that much blood coming out of him. It's like, no, this is pretty severe. There was probably a big chance that if he would have carried on, that they would have stopped it through the fact that he might have even lost his tongue. You know, that's how bad it was.
Yeah, and as you said, he actually didn't even mention that until well after the fight. But yeah, I mean, could you imagine that? I mean, you could literally, as they are in the inside, it's sort of like their heads have come together. And as you sort of, I think Eubank described it as when you've got your sort of chin on someone's shoulder, and then as you come away, your mouth is slightly open. So that's why when he's actually thrown this massive uppercut, his mouth being slightly open, after he just caught his tongue, obviously bit his tongue, and as you say, he was trying to hide the evidence from Ronnie Davis and obviously the doctors, because he didn't want them to pick up on the fact that he had so much blood in his mouth and he didn't want the fight to be stopped. Which again just shows you that, you know, for all the things that Eubank was, he was very self-confident, and he was a bit of a prick, let's be honest. He had a real will to want to fight and win. So credit to him, really.
It was always remembered, this fight, for the commentary, the ITV commentary. Obviously, the commentators got so into this that Jim McDonald was like, "Jesus, look at that right hand!" And it was just you got the big fight feel of everything. You know, when the commentators play, some people slag them off, don't they? In this day and age, like the some of the shit they come out with, but like I think you felt every punch with the way the expressions of the commentators came across on the telly. Like, you've got the guys like Jim McDonald shouting, "Jesus," you know, that's not something you kind of get now. It's more scripted, I think. It's more, they've got their own sort of things sort of set out for them, whereas now it was more like they're saying it as they see it and as they felt it, as opposed to it's being specific about certain things that I was saying. And that really made a difference to me watching the fight back. It kind of got you really sort of engaged in the action that was going on in the ring, and it kind of led you to feel something was happening more than what you actually thought it was. You know, going into that fifth round, Ben's eye was actually swollen shut because of the amount of punishment he was taking on the way in to get to Chris Eubank. And then in the sixth, Eubank started throwing shots at Ben, who was covering up on the ropes. Ben then caught Eubank with a low blow, and with no points deducted, he started using that to his advantages, with the fact the referee didn't do nothing about it. Started pounding Eubank to the body, and it was just an amazing, amazing couple of rounds where they were both getting involved in some great exchanges.
Yeah, definitely. That low blow definitely clearly upset Eubank's rhythm. He was in pretty much in control. As you say, Ben's eye obviously almost closed shut now by this point. And so he's thrown that punch, obviously it was low. And Eubank, to his credit again, you know, he's bit his tongue, and now he's been punched in the buttocks. And as you say, Richard Steele, the ref, who was an established referee at the time. He could have given him a bit longer. I mean, we see one recently with Amir Khan, and how he just bottled that completely. Eubank give himself a few seconds, and he was back in there, clearly in discomfort. Ben, clever in his tactics, as you say, targeted the body. I mean, the last thing we need is, you know, you can imagine being the fighter getting caught in the Goonies, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're getting smashed in the body, you know what I mean, by someone who's a big puncher. That's the last thing you want. You know, everybody knows you feel a bit sick, and your belly hurts a bit, doesn't it, afterwards. So very clever tactics from Ben, and as you say, worked the body really well, and it was clearly taking effect on Eubank. But obviously, with Ben, with his eye, you know, he knew he had to do something different. And with that granite chin, which Eubank clearly showed in this fight, he got caught a few times with some big hands, big right hands. And so it wasn't the chin that was going to put him down. It was always going to be the body. And you could see in Ben's eyes, specifically in the sixth and seventh, when he was really whipping them shots in deep, wasn't he, Ben? And they were taking some effect. And even one point, Eubank even glances over to Richard Steele, ref. And when you see that in a fight, you started to think, oh, hold on a minute. I think this is on the turn, this fight. You know, he's looking for a way out here. But again, credit to Eubank, he fought on.
He did, he fought back in the seventh. He really did, and he started to turn the fight a little bit around in his favour. And then as we get into the eighth round, the scores are fairly even as we start that round. But this point, when I was talking about earlier about how the effects of the weight drain might start to catch up with Ben, and it was evident, and this is where I felt he started to catch up with him in the fight going into the eighth. He became a little bit more wary going into the eighth round now. He was looking to kind of pick these one-punch shots on Eubank. He was just like throwing, they weren't entirely wild, but in my eyes, it was kind of like he was only throwing the one shot, looking for that one punch knockout. Now, actually, he did catch Eubank on the top of the head with an overhand right after he trapped Eubank in the corner. Now, that meant that he went down. He was up there quick, said it was a slip. No, it's a slip, it's a slip. That's what he was saying to the Richard Steele, the referee. But he had to take the eight count regardless from Richard Steele.
I'm surprised that Eubank hasn't tried to make better use of his jab, because Ben does come straight on him.
Yeah, exactly. Professes to be a master of the noble art. Oh, what? Almost came out on our lap, Jim. A little bit of a slip. He's arguing with the referee it was a slip. But there's no point in him shouting at him because he got clipped at the same time.
I think it was a bit of both, Rez. It was a slip. It was a punch that caused him to slip, so you got to count.
And that was a really interesting part of the fight, because at this point, with the fight being so even, that was significant, because that now meant that it was a 10-8 round automatically, which meant that essentially Ben's two rounds in front. So this is where Eubank really had to start coming back, and he finished the round pretty strongly. And what was interesting is that at the end of the round, round number 8, he's posing again. He's arrogant. He's just ridiculous. Like, he's just posing. And he did it in a couple of the rounds throughout the fight, which I've not touched on. But when you watch the fight back, you just see him doing this pose. And I always refer back to today. Chris Eubank Jr. used to do exactly the same up until recently. He'd stand in between the rounds in the corner when they get the 1 minute break. And he'd just stand there staring at the opponent. And Eubank was exactly the same in this fight with Ben.
Oh, yeah, we didn't touch on that. I mean, even from the first round, he actually, because the camera goes straight onto Ben's corner and you don't actually see it, but Eubank was actually strolling around in his corner before he actually, for about 10 seconds, before he actually went back to Ronnie Davis. And as you say, he was doing exactly the same thing. I think, again, it's just to prove that it's his way of saying to everybody, look, you know, I've got this, you know what I mean? Don't worry, this is in the bag type of thing. If anything, he's trying to sway the judges as well. But, I mean, as you say, that knockdown, whether it was a slip or not, I mean, I've watched it so many times. I mean, at the time, as I kicked going back to my household while this fight was on, my brother was unbelievably just jumping around, shadow boxing away, and he thought it was over. Obviously, it wasn't, and he still to this day would always say it was never a slip. He took it down. I've watched it. It's difficult because he does catch him right behind the ear, and with the way like that crab like style that Eubank had, whether he would have gone low and just moved out of the way, and maybe there was a little bit of water and he slipped on it. He was absolutely fine, as you said, Sean, and he was ready to carry on. But I think the one problem for Ben was the eye. It was. Clearly, it was completely shut by this point. And Eubank was a clever fighter, a clever boxer, as I touched on, with Ben being a clever fighter, using the body after sort of getting him in the balls. And he targeted that eye, and he worked it well. I'm moving into that last round for him.
That's it, the ninth and the final round of this particular fight. And again, we talk about the Legendary Night series and about some of the greatest fights we ever watched. This is where it started to make it greatest fight, Legendary Night territory, when this nine round came about. Because what started out as what you believed was going to be a Ben round turned into something completely different. So the round started as the previous rounds had started, really. Both men were going for it. Both men knew, you know, this was do or die. And going into that ninth round, which I've got to say, if you've not seen the ninth round of this particular fight, and you're listening at this point, then you obviously need to go and watch it, because it was an unbelievable, unbelievable round, because it was quite an even round as it started out, and it was up until Eubank missed with a right. Ben caught him with a left hook, which landed on Eubank, who was a little bit unbalanced at this point, and it sent him down. So standing up, Eubank again circled Ben before releasing a left-right combination and a left hook, which staggered Ben. Ben survived that little flurry and got into the clinch. And then Eubank then, this is where you said earlier, and you quite rightly pointed out that he was known for being a fantastic finisher. He got a straight right from Eubank, sent Ben into the corner, and it was at this point where Richard Seale had seen enough and decided that he was going to step in to end the flurry with 5 seconds left of round number nine.
He was calling for that.
That was Ben.
Oh, what a shot that
was. Shot Hillershipper.
Opened him up with the left hand and then shot the right hand over, and it connected. There's the countdown. If he did go down, the count would continue.
Ben has been shaking, Reg.
Oh, right to his boots, Jim.
Ben is shaking. The eyes wash, Reg. This will be the finish of the build.
It's all over in the ninth round. And would you believe in Ben's corner, they looked as though they were objecting to that for a minute. Why was it stopped? But I think he was right to dive in there. Apart from the eye closing, he was also getting punished at that point, Jim.
Wow, when you go back and watch this fight, and you go back and watch this particular round, what a way for a fight to end. It was like Corrales Castillo all over.
It really was, wasn't it? And credit to Eubank. I mean, the fight was, I mean, on my scorecard, even when I scored it again, I had Ben, obviously, with the knockdown, I had Ben up by a round. If obviously, whether it was a knockdown or not, I mean, it could have been an even round if that wasn't a knockdown. It was called as a slip, but very tight going into that ninth round, and you could almost feel like Ben was in the ascendancy in a way, even though his eye was completely shut. But maybe, you know, as you say, having to burn off 6.5 pounds in 3 hours is not going to do you any good on come the night of the fight. And that was the morning of the fight, you know, only eating half a sandwich, and definitely took its toll on Ben. And I think it, you know, with the eye as well, and it was clinical. Eubank, very clinical. You know, he did catch Ben. He wobbled him a couple of times, as you say, momentarily. Ben escaped by sort of going in for the clinch. And then Ben was pinned to the neutral corner. Eubank ran combos until the referee obviously stopped it. With Ben on his feet, Eubank sank to his knees in jubilation. I mean, the one thing I'll say is with Ben, I suppose with some refs, they probably would have allowed it for the round to finish and allowed it to go to the 10th, even though he was getting hit with his hands down, using his face, if you like, as a defence. But that was Ben. Like, as we touched on with the Logan fight, for instance, he took, I think they even said, 22 shots, combinations, before he threw that left to knock Logan out. So I suppose that's where I'm with you. I think he should have stopped it, but just through, you know, looking at Ben in previous fights, maybe he could have gone on. I mean, the eye was done in a way. He even said himself, I couldn't see the shots coming. But, you know, Ben, as I've always said, and one thing you'd always know of Ben, he was like a wounded animal. As soon as he's in trouble, he'd throw something. Ben had no arguments. It was a fair stoppage, and it deserved to. And Eubank, to his credit, deserved to win the fight.
Richard Seale, the referee of this fight, was quoted as saying this was the most dramatic fight he'd ever refereed at this point. And obviously, this
wow.
This fight to this day is obviously still considered one of the best fights, you know, not even just in Britain, but one of the best fights in world boxing. And this is why. Two guys, middleweight, in the prime, going for the world title, and this is what we get, an unbelievable fight. And it makes me proud as a British fighter fan to be a British fighter fan when we've got this sort of lineage of fights under our belts to be able to look back on and be able to talk about that. You know, this happened with two British guys involved. And what an unbelievable fight. And I can only really say to the people that listen to the episodes, and, you know, if you've watched the fight already after listening to the podcast that we do, then, you know, we really appreciate it, because this is what gets us hyped up to go and watch these fights. We record it, we put it out, and then we listen back and we're like, oh, I might go watch that fight again. And I know that's the same, that is exactly the same feeling from your side as well. And obviously a lot of guys that know, that I know, that listen to our podcast, and a lot of people that support the podcast, when they listen to it and they send little messages through to me on Twitter, and it's like, no, I really enjoyed that episode. This is why it's unbelievable to be able to talk about fights like this. And I think it kind of, it leads us nicely then into the aftermath for both of these guys then. Unbelievable fight. But it wasn't the end for these two, was it? Because they ended up going on, as you said at the start of the episode, to go on to have a second fight, which was a bigger fight in terms of the magnitude of it, because it actually happened at Manchester United's football ground, Old Trafford, and it was one of the biggest boxing events that had been staged at this point, especially in Britain in particular. This was an unbelievable event, the second fight, and at the time, both of them had moved up in weights. Ben was the WBC super middleweight champion, Eubank, the WBO super middleweight champion, and what we got in there was another unbelievable fight. Not as good as this first one that we've covered, but still another great, fantastic fight.
Again, I mean, Barry Earn is, you know, I think they both ended up signing with Barry after this fight as well. Although they, I think, you know, with Ben, he had so many. I think he had Burt McCarthy, Frank Warren, Frank Maloney, Barry Earn, Terry Marsh, Ambrose Mendy, Bob Arum, and Don King all promoted Ben. So Ben went for his promoters as well as his trainers. I mean, he had five trainers in his career as well. But you know, this, you've got to give Barry Earn credit for the way he put this together. You know, he guided them separately. They obviously went off and had their separate fights, and he sort of built it up as he tries to do, I suppose, now with Anthony Joshua. And they called it, the contest was named Judgment Day.
Yes.
It was reported that 500 million people, 500 million. It's 500 million apparently watched the fight. It was an exciting contest. It was full Old Trafford, 50,000 people, and obviously, with a pound note, you know, Don King could spend a pound note a mile off, so he was obviously involved with Don King. And then it was a brilliant fight. Again, it was a draw, which was a bit of an anticlimax. I mean, I do remember this fight more as a sort of early teen, if you like. I thought Ben won the fight. I've watched it back. I still think Ben wins the fight. I don't know if that's because I just don't like Eubank, I suppose, maybe. But, you know, it was a draw. It was what it was. But it was an exit. It just showed you that how today, where we move from these sort of 20,000 arenas or 30,000 arenas, whatever they hold, to Wembley Stadium, this was basically that. You know, you're at the NEC in front of 10,000 people, and then you move it to Old Trafford in front of 50,000. And that was what they brought. They brought the fans, they brought the media, America. They had two world titles at super middleweight on the line. It was just beautiful. That is what, it all stems from this one particular fight. That was an absolute belter. And a wonderful fight. And again, anyone, please just go and watch it. Have a look at the second one as well as the first, because it really was an excellent contest.
So just briefly touching on Nigel Benn's career after this point. Obviously, we talked about the fact that he did have a second fight up at super middleweight with Chris Eubank Jr. Yeah. He would then campaign the rest of his career up at super middleweight, being involved with fights with Henry Wharton, Juan Carlos Jimenez, and then the epic fight, which was also a sad turn of events with Gerald McClellan. I feel like that Gerald McClellan fight is probably one to potentially put down in the future as another episode for this series, because of the fight itself, not so much the aftermath with what happened to McClellan, but the fight itself was an unbelievable fight, and another fight where, as always, Nigel Benn was always the underdog. He was always a man against the odds, so he had a fantastic fight with McClellan, and then he moved on and two more great fights which he were involved in, with two fights with Steve Collins in 1996, and he actually retired in 1996, his final fight against Steve Collins, and that was the end of Nigel Benn in that point. I always thought maybe he would decide to try and come back for one more go, like Eubank did in his career. But yeah, unbelievable end to what was a pretty good career from Nigel Benn.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he did have... He obviously had that sort of... He had an early peak, didn't he, just before the Eubank fight, and then went to America and sorted it. It was the Witt fight. Went to America, sorted himself out, got himself better after the Watson fight. So he recovered, won a title, lost to Eubank, and then basically, as you say, he just sort of licked his wounds, got himself back in. This was by no means the end of Ben, and he went on to obviously win the WBC title in Italy, and obviously then had the draw with Eubank, and then obviously, as you say, the Gerald McKillen fight was... the tragedy that surrounds it is always obviously going to be the one thing that people will always mention, and it wasn't good for the sport in terms of how it ended. But in terms of the fight itself, what an unbelievable fight. It really was brilliant. This guy, Gerald McKinnon, he was the big puncher. He was the Ben of 22 fights and 22 knockouts. He was the guy that was supposed to go in and just literally wipe the floor with Ben. And it looked like it was going to happen. I think loads and loads of reporters put down that I think they all thought it'd be over in the first round. And they almost got it right. I mean, the way it was going, it looked that way. Ben recovered well, and then obviously as the fight wore on, obviously we all know what happened with the blinking and McKinnon, etc. But I mean, he had a couple of right knobs in his corner, didn't he? His whole entourage was it wasn't a nice fella. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, he wasn't a nice guy. If anyone wants to go read about the guy, he wasn't very nice. Doesn't mean that he should deserve to have what happened to him, but if anything, just go and watch that fight. It really is. I mean, if anyone's got Box Nation, they have it on probably once a week, that one, because it's so good.
Yeah, I agree. And then we look at Chris Eubank's career after this fight, and he was obviously involved in epic fights as well. Just touching on the fights with Michael Watson again, another sort of tragic turn of events in the fights with Michael Watson. He beat Watson in the first one, and then obviously beat him in the second one, but obviously, unfortunately, Michael Watson collapsed at the end of the 11th round in the second fight, and obviously the rest is history. But he also was involved in other great fights with a notable opponent in Falana Malinga as well. He got involved with him. He also fought Juan Carlos Jimenez as well, and then he was also involved in some great fights down the line with the likes of Steve Collins. There again, they're probably other episodes we can cover off for Legendary Nights, because they were the two fights with Steve Collins were just fantastic nights and fantastic build-ups to talk about. And then obviously he had his final three fights of his career. Unfortunately, they were all losses, unanimous decision losses, but he would fight a future star in Joe Calzaghe in 97, which was for the vacant WBO super middleweight title. He then decided to come back in 98 and fight up at cruiserweight against Cal the Cat Thompson in two great fights against Cal Thompson there. So Eubank also had a great career. And just to summarise both men's careers, they both became world champions in two separate weights. And that's a feat that not a lot of boxers can say they ever did. And that is why a lot of fans regard them as British boxing legends.
Oh, absolutely. I think, with Eubank, Ben, it was obviously their rivalry. When you think of one, you think of the other, which alone for me is enough. Too many guys may hold unbelievable, throughout their weight, they can hold several different titles and different weights, but that you struggle to find that partner they tangled with, if you like. Styles make fights, as they say, but also you need someone with you. When you think of Gatti, you think of Walls. When you think of Eubank, you think of Ben. When you think of Ali, you think of Frazier. No matter what, anybody, people will always remember that for those two fights. And obviously their careers, they both had magnificent careers, as you say, in two separate weights. I mean, even Ronnie Davis, when Eubank moved up to super middleweight, although it was only a brief spell, Ronnie Davis actually felt that he was a beast at light heavy. So who knows, if he'd have moved up to light heavy, maybe he could have gone on to do even more things earlier than he did, that is. But I mean, they were just excellent fights. I mean the Watson fight, for instance, again, it was a tragic turn of events, but I think people forget that is actually one of Eubank's best performances. He was down on the scorecards and he needed to finish the fight by a knockout and stopped him. I mean, obviously it was tragic what happened, but I think people just overlook that it was an outstanding performance from Eubank. And then obviously it goes on to with the two Collins fights, which Collins, he knew what he was doing. He knew to target. And Eubank, after that Watson fight, we mentioned it with Ben, he was very clinical in the finish. And he even said himself that he lost that clinical finish going forward. I mean, you look at his resume and a lot of his fights went 12 rounds and went the distance. Although he wasn't a massive knockout puncher, he had times when he would knock him out with one punch. And it was just the way he would finish a fight. And I think he even said himself he'd take his foot off the gas. With Collins, there was an instance where he could have pressed on and he sort of decided to take it to 12 because he was worried. And I think the same with Cole Thompson. He put him down, I think, in the first fight. And he could have pressed on and he didn't. So, you know, where they both, you know, you think of one, you think of the other, but they also had those tragic fights as well. So they are just moulded into one. I mean, they still talk about it today, how much they hate each other, how much they would have a third one, even today. Would I watch it? I probably would. I'm not even joking, I probably would watch it. So they were just, it was a great fight. It had everything. It was a classic. It was unforgettable. I mean, so the words just found me. I mean, it was a battle of wits, a battle of wills. You know, it was a fight of the ages. And I think that is 100% a legendary night. And they, as you say, they could even feature further on down the line. So maybe when we do other polls, I think I wouldn't be surprised if Ben McClellan comes out as a winner, because that was another great fight. And obviously Collins against Eubank, their first one in particular, was another great fight. Calzaghe, as you mentioned, sorry. I'm rabbiting on it, but it's just, there's so many fights. They're a credit to British boxing, and they're a credit to boxing as a whole. And they actually, WBO, they, you know, they were a small, unrecognised organisation at the time. And if anything, it's probably down to Ben Eubank that WBO has now become what it is today.
And I can't disagree with that last statement there, because you're probably right. It was probably the pioneering fight for their world championship and their organisation. Also, on a side note then, going back to what you were talking about there, if anybody that's listening has not seen a good documentary about these two going in against each other and their particular rivalry, ITV did a documentary a few years back called The Best Ever Big Fight Live, and it was former world champion Duke McKenzie and Barry McGuigan talking about this particular rivalry. Duke McKenzie saying it's a rivalry that may never be rivaled, with Barry McGuigan also agreeing to say there was real empathy and ill will between them two. But what fights. The legacy of the feud is definitely going to be summed up by this first fight for me. And the moniker of a war to end all wars is perfect for not just this fight, but the whole Ben Eubank saga in general. It was definitely a war to end all wars. And what an unbelievable fight to cover. And I know we always bang on about how unbelievable fights are, but genuinely, if you're not a big fan of boxing, these are the types of fights that get you loving the sport. These are the types of fights that get the casual audience on board. People that may just like a fight like this, they'll only watch boxing for fights like this. If you've never watched this fight and you're listening to this episode for the first time, then we implore you to go and find the fight on YouTube. There is some really good high quality versions of the fight on there. Go and look at the fight, go and watch the fight, and go and look back at what an event it really was and how good of a fight it really was. And I've got to be honest, Johnston, it was when this won the poll, I was so excited to do it, because I've got such fond memories of both of these fighters growing up in the 90s and enjoying boxing as a fan in the 90s. So it was great to cover this one today on this episode, and I'm really glad that we've had the opportunity to do it.
Oh, absolutely. And going back and just recapping, and, you know, as you put it so well, in terms of it really was an unbelievable pioneering. I mean, we mentioned it in the last pod with Lennon and Duran, but these fights, this is what makes it legendary, the way that they're so significant that sort of the rest of boxing follows suit. And that's what puts these guys in the Hall of Fame. I think Ben's only just been put in the Hall of Fame like last year, I think. I'm not sure if Eubank's even in there. I honestly don't know. But they deserve to be, because of, you know, people will always say, you know, a Hall of Famer, you know, that should be like a Sugar Ray Leonard, or it should be like, you know, an Ali. But these guys, it's not just about how good, they were great to watch, fantastic to watch, but their rivalry itself belongs there. It makes boxing. It's, as you say, for the average fan, I was an 8-year-old boy watching my brother and his mate, and just unbelievably, I couldn't believe what I was watching. I was sort of watching his, I was watching them more than a fight. I have memories of my brother shadow boxing. So to watch a fan, you know, he obviously my brother, but watching a fan react the way he did, that was how it was throughout the whole of England. And 1990 was a key year in England. We were riding that wave from the World Cup. You know, even Gazza was in attendance on the night with Linford Christie and whoever else was there. But it was just it was compelling. It was classic. It was thrilling. And the both guys deserve utmost respect, because they were warriors, man. These guys were tough brothers. And yeah, it's just Yeah, it was brilliant to watch back, and I really enjoyed every minute of it. And one thing I have to say, well, I've got a note here which always made me laugh, which I probably should have said earlier, was that one quote from Nigel Benn was that you can put Maradona on yourself to score goals, Steve Davis to pop balls, and me to kick off.
What a great way to close out the show with that quote. And guys, I hope you really enjoyed it. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Like I say, I know there's quite a few of you out there that message and always say they look forward to each episode of Legendary Night. So I hope, again, we've done this fight justice, and I hope we've been able to take you on a recap through history about this fight and about the event and obviously what it meant for British boxing in general. So if you've really enjoyed it, please let us know about it. Go on Twitter and tweet us at BTR Boxing Pod. If you've not already subscribed to the podcast and this is the first time you've listened to us, go over and find us on Apple Podcasts or on Podbean. We're on all available podcasting apps out there. Go and find us and subscribe, because we don't just do this. We do a Ones to Watch series featuring all prospects from around the UK and the world. We also do a weekly review and preview episode. So go and check us out on social media as well, on Twitter at BTR Boxing Pod and BTR Boxing Podcast. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll see you on the next episode of BTR's Legendary Nights.
And right now, Thomas Hearns is an open book for Ray Leonard. Backs up against the ropes.
This is one of the most unusual calls by a referee in the history of the sport.
The first loss, a tremendous victory. Leonard fighting off the ropes.
It happened. It happened. An uppercut by Douglas. Down goes Tyson.
Puts in right hand shot.
Lennox Lawrence knocks out by Tyson.
The champion struggles to stay on his feet.
How do you like it? How do you like it?
Sports Social Podcast Network.